Hello, listeners. This is The Europeans, the podcast that is making Europe great again. Dominic's husband really hates that tagline, so I thought I'd say it at the top just to piss him off. Hi, Thomas. This is Katie. I am a journalist in Paris.
And this is Dominic. I'm an opera singer in the Netherlands.
If you're listening to this on the day it comes out, then it's May Day, an ancient European spring festival, according to Wikipedia, and International Workers' Day, of course. And it's a public holiday across most of the continent, I think. So we hope you're having a nice day off, maybe listening to the Europeans.
And skipping around the Maypole.
Oh, yes, you could do that. Or maybe smashing in some of the windows of multinational corporations. If you're an anarchist May Day protest, don't do that. We don't condone violence on this programme. How has your week been, Dominic Kramer?
It's been fine. I went on the direct Eurostar from London to Amsterdam for the first time, which was very exciting and somewhat disappointing because it was nearly 2 hours delayed, which kind of defeats the point of getting to London to Amsterdam really quickly.
Isn't it crazy that you can take a train from all the way from London to Amsterdam now? I know that seems obvious, but it's mad.
It is absolutely amazing. And my family house in London is like not that far from St. Pancras, and my house here in Amsterdam is not that far away from Central Station. So it's like quicker than going from London to Edinburgh. I'm so happy about it.
Yay.
How's your week been, Katie?
My week's been good. I've been up on the Somme in northern France on like what used to be the Western Front in World War One, getting up at 1:30 in the morning to stand in a field full of Australian people who were marking 100 years since this major World War One battle.
Were they confused with the jet lag? Did they get up at 1:30 and they're like, oh, this is morning in Australia?
Well, I partly thought that's why we were doing it. I'm just really ignorant about Australia and didn't realise that for Anzac Day, which is their national memorial day every year, everyone gets up at dawn to remember the war dead. So it was very, very moving. I didn't really know about this much before, but World War One was like this really key moment in the forming of Australia's national identity, because it was like a really young nation at the time and the only massive, massive war that they'd been involved in. So it was really interesting to talk to all these Aussies who come all the way around the world, who felt that it was really important to come and find the graves of like great, great uncles to come and pay their respects. So it was really interesting. And I haven't been up there in northern France on like the old war site since I was a kid on a school trip. It's quite a classic British school trip to go to northern France or Belgium just to see the war cemeteries up there. And it's going to sound a little bit sentimental, but just seeing all these graves again, all from these different countries, like a lot of them just these guys who were 19 or 20 years old, it really hit home again, like how it wasn't that long ago that we were all killing each other on this continent and how amazing it is that we don't do that anymore.
Yeah, and this week or last week, it looked like maybe we're moving further away from doing that again with the wonderful news from North Korea, which we'll see whether it is wonderful news or not. We'll come back to you on that.
At the time of recording, it was wonderful news, and yeah. The world seems like a slightly brighter place. But in Europe in general, it's been quite a busy week. We've had these massive opposition protests in Armenia, massive protests in Spain as well over this awful gang rape case that apparently wasn't legally a gang rape.
We've had two big European visits to the White House with Macron and Merkel. And in fact, maybe I'm stealing the good week. Should we go straight into good week before we talk any more about that?
Yes, but first of all, let's just quickly tell you what's coming up in this episode. We're going to be talking about anti-Semitism, rising anti-Semitism in Germany with Wenzel Michalski. He's the German director of Human Rights Watch, and he sadly has a very personal experience of this problem. On a more cheerful note, though, we're going to be balancing piles of rocks. My friend Andy Buchanan, who is a wonderful photographer based in the beautiful city of Glasgow in Scotland, he's been shooting a kind of crazy event this week, the European Stone Stacking Championships on the Scottish coast. All will become clear after Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Quick update on last week's Good Week, Bad Week. Do you remember that Icelandic guy who did a runner after being accused of masterminding a Bitcoin heist?
Oh, he's been found, hasn't he?
Yeah, in Amsterdam. I don't suppose you had anything to do with that, Dominic.
Yeah, it was all thanks to me. Someone actually did call me, as you requested. They called me first, and I said, no, call Interpol. and yeah, he's been caught.
Well done.
So, back in our episode from January the 9th, we interviewed Georgi Gotev about the fact that Bulgaria were taking the sixth-month position as host of the European presidency. Now, as we talked about back then, there was a bit of nervousness about this, seeing as Bulgaria is, according to Transparency International, the most corrupt country in Europe. That said, there was some optimism from Gyorgy that like the presidency might lead to more scrutiny for the political elite of Bulgaria and that there'd be some protests that would like shine a light on things that need shining a light on. That's exactly what's happened. Bulgaria is back in the spotlight due to accusations of mismanagement at the European Youth Forum in Sofia last week. So one of the responsibilities when holding the EU presidency is to hold a youth conference for which the country receives a grant from the EU executive. And thanks to reporting on Euroactive.com from Gyorgy himself and Sarantis Mikalopoulos, it was revealed that the event had some pretty awkward flaws, I'd say. The president of the European Youth Forum, Luis Alvaro, accused the Sofia event of, quote, destroying the work of generations before us and disregarding young people at all cost.
Jesus, that's quite intense. What went on?
Well, there's quite a long list of allegations, which include volunteers being forced to applaud the Prime Minister's speech and stand up. Complimentary hard alcohol being served.
Yes!
Yeah, which, I don't know, is that really unusual for a youth event? Maybe it is. But what is very unusual, definitely, is the fact that there were half-naked female dancers dancing on tables at one of the parties, even though there'd been a talk about gender equality earlier in the day. Yeah, no half-naked male dancers. So, yeah, it's not equal.
Grossly unfair.
There was also apparently a severe shortage of interpreters for the deaf youths that had been invited, leading to a sense of exclusion. And Alvarado also said that there was no young and European elected representatives on any panel of discussion of the conference. So, overall, not an unmitigated success. Bad week. European Youth Conference, Sofia, bad week.
That sounds like kind of the worst party ever, but kind of the kind of party where you would need a lot of hard alcohol just to kind of take the edge off all the scantily clad ladies dancing and everything. I'm quite offended that we didn't get invited to this. We're young Europeans. Why weren't we there?
Yeah, I don't know. We're not cool enough. Or they knew we wouldn't approve of the semi-naked ladies dancing on tables, which, I mean, I don't judge any ladies for dancing semi-nakedly on a table, but I just don't think it should be at like a European youth event.
Such a prude.
Yeah. So strangely, this story hasn't really been picked up by the mainstream media, and Gyorgy and his team at Euroactive have been pushing it. I think it's quite a good story and something that people need to know about. Maybe it's just because it's Bulgaria.
Well, it's going to go viral now that it's been on our show, so don't worry.
Absolutely. Who's it been a good week for, Katie?
It's been a good week for Emmanuel Macron, with the caveat that it was a good week tinged with humiliation. Macron's been in Washington, D.C., cementing his bromance with Donald Trump.
Ugh, I hate the word bromance.
Oh, it's nice. We're having a bromance.
No, we are not. We are not bros.
Yes, we are.
Anyway, carry on. Sorry for interrupting.
A couple of very awkward moments, not least this thing with the dandruff. Trump making a very big show of brushing off an apparent bit of dandruff from Macron's shoulder. Quite obvious and sad power play, which was pretty embarrassing for Macron, but I think he did a fairly decent job of laughing it off. Embarrassing moments aside, I think Macron's generally been able to fly home thinking this was a successful trip. He came away not looking like too much of a brown noser. So he came there with his big smile and his back slapping and really massaged Trump's ego. But then he did this big speech in Congress where he ripped into everything that Trump stands for. It was a pretty clear pitch, I think, that he wants to be leader of the free world. And despite some of the political problems at home that he's facing, which we talked about a couple of episodes ago, around the world, I think he's probably made a pretty good international impression.
I mean, the reports I read suggested that like it went down quite well in France, because he's been having a bit of a difficult time, hasn't he, in the polls. And maybe this will boost his image at home.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know how much normal people pay attention to like foreign affairs in general. I haven't seen any polls coming out of this yet of like whether it's actually boosted his numbers, but his numbers are actually pretty rubbish at the moment. Like 60% of the country thinks he's doing a bad job as president. So it will be quite interesting to see if they do go up a bit. But I think it's mostly tends to be informed by domestic policy, but he might get a bump. You never know.
I was amazed speaking to some colleagues in the Netherlands, some of whom aren't necessarily interested in politics at all, that they had all seen clips of Macron's speech in America, and it made me think that actually he'd done quite a good job at like creating a video that could go viral, and it's been watched by millions and millions on Facebook already.
He's excellent at that. I think 1 year into the Macron presidency, because we're coming up this week to the 1 year anniversary, the one thing I've learned about him watching him and following him for a year is that he is amazing at communications. He has a great communications team about him. The branding is excellent. And he's doing this really good job, I think, of coming off as a global statesman, somebody who wants to be like a defender of like liberal values. And internationally, it's kind of working for him.
Listeners, you can probably see that our artwork is Macron's face. And if you want to hear the story behind how this happened and how it was made, then we were featured on a podcast called I Should Start a Podcast. We were interviewed on this week's, on last week's episode and the weeks before. But this one last week was called... I should have prepared this. Packaged with Care. In this short episode, it talks about branding and packaging your podcast. And Katie gets quite a nice barbed review for her Photoshop skills.
He said that our artwork breaks every rule in the book, but somehow still kind of works, which I'm going to take as a compliment. So I didn't think we'd be talking about Auschwitz and rap music this week, but here we are.
Yeah, that happened.
So there's been this big row over anti-Semitism in Germany this week. At the heart of it are two rappers, Kodiger and Farid Bang. And there's been a massive uproar after they won Best Hip Hop Award at the Echo Awards, which is kind of Germany's answer to like the MTV Awards or the Brit Awards or something like that. For this album, JBG3, which compared their muscles... to those of Holocaust victims. Let's play a bit of the tape. And then there was a second song on this album, which included the lyrics, I'm doing another Holocaust coming with the Molotov. So it's horrible, obviously, and there's been massive outrage over this in Germany because it comes at a time of fears of rising anti-Semitism. There have, however, been like quite a lot of street protests this week in support of Jewish people, people wearing the kippah, the skull cap, in support of the Jewish community and saying this cannot happen, we can't let this happen, which is very cheering to see. And a bunch of musicians gave back their Echo Awards and have now, in fact, scrapped the prizes altogether, which is a massive thing. I think it shows just quite how intense the reaction has been to this.
So there's been a pretty constant stream of reports of anti-Semitic abuse over the whole continent of Europe over the last few months. It seems to be rising. Just last week, there was a video that emerged of a 21-year-old Israeli man wearing a kippah being physically attacked and verbally abused for being Jewish in Berlin. This and other cases has shaken Germany in particular, but there've been lots of similarly awful cases in France, haven't there, Katie? You probably know more about them than me.
The latest one was the murder of this old lady called Mireille Canol in Paris, not far from where I live. She was stabbed 11 times and then her attackers burned her body. And the police are treating this as an anti-Semitic crime. As far as we can work out, the alleged perpetrators of this attack did it because they thought she was rich. They knew that she was Jewish and they thought she's Jewish, she'll have money. So they robbed her and they killed her. And it was just a horrific crime. So there's definitely a national conversation going on in France at the moment about this problem, where it's coming from and what we can do about it.
There's also a lot of talk of anti-Semitism on the left of the political spectrum in the UK, where the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn has been criticised for not doing enough to stamp out anti-Semitism within its own ranks. I think it's a minority problem within the party, but it is still a problem. And the party have been criticised for not dealing with it quickly and taking it seriously enough. So it seems to appear in lots of different forms, anti-Semitism, sometimes violent, sometimes subtle political moves. We found a good person to talk to about this. We've got the German director of Human Rights Watch, Wenzel Michalski, who last year made headlines in a personal context because he opened up about some atrocious anti-Semitic abuse that his son had received at school. We started by asking him what had happened.
My son went to a very multicultural school. He liked the idea of going to a multicultural school. And the first week was great. He found new friends. At the end of the week, on Friday, the teacher asked, what kind of houses of worship do you know? So the pupils said church and mosque. And when it was my son's turn, he said synagogue. And the teacher said, what? Are you Jewish? And that was the end of the happy times. The same day, his new friends told him, we can't meet on the weekend because you might be a cool guy, but you are the Jew, and Jews are terrible. They are our enemies. They stink, and so on and so forth. So he was very upset, he told us, and we went to the headmaster and spoke to him and said, look, you have a problem with anti-Semitism at your school, but we can help. And they refused that. It became worse and worse. First, it started with verbal attacks, and kids started to kick him, to throw his head in the dirt, and he was also beaten up very, very badly. So he had bruises that stayed for a long time. And it all escalated when he was attacked with a gun. Turned out it was a replica gun, but it looked really, really like a real gun. And he was suffocated until he lost consciousness. And that was the point where we took him out of school. The headmaster later said it was a pity that we took our boy out of school because we did it in protest, and so he didn't have a chance to change anything. But for months and months and months, we begged him, and we wrote emails to him. We tried to call him, and he was never available for us, and he refused to see what was going on in his school.
Oh, we're so sorry to hear that. It's just horrendous. Is he doing better now, your son?
Yes, he's at a very nice school now, and he's doing very much better. And that just shows you that there can be things done against anti-Semitism or racism at the school.
Do you feel like things have got considerably worse in the last few years, or do you think it's just kind of been a dormant anti-Semitism that people haven't been talking about?
There is a dormant anti-Semitism, and you are confronted with anti-Semitism as soon as you leave your circles. People like us, we choose our friends, and then we can live here years and years and years and years without experiencing anti-Semitism personally or privately. But as soon as you go out of the bubble, it can become really rough and dangerous, as we have seen the other day. Two kids were walking down the trendy Prenzlauer Berg with a kippah on their head, and they immediately were attacked. It has also become worse, first of all, because of the right-wing AfD now being in the parliament in Germany at the Bundestag. So things that you wouldn't have said before is suddenly acceptable. And people are much more openly xenophobic, racist, Islamophobe. Plus, I think the liberal left was sleeping and did not realize and recognize and acknowledge their own anti-Semitism. And that is a problem, because Germany has wonderful memorials and plaques on houses, and Germany is very proud of that. I think they thought it was more comfortable on ritualizing the feeling of responsibility after the Holocaust and guilt on certain days and in certain places, but never really confront the uncomfortable truth that maybe Uncle Rudy or Auntie Helga were involved in Nazi atrocities.
The attacks on Jewish people are coming from many different sides across Europe at the moment. We've got the rise of the far right, which often has anti-Semitic elements. In the UK, for example, the far left has been seen to have some elements of anti-Semitism as well. And also there's the wave of migrants fleeing Syria and parts of the Middle East who come in with some ingrained anti-Semitic views. I feel like all these issues have to be kind of addressed slightly separately. You can't quite fix this problem of anti-Semitism with just one plaster that will fix it all. Do you have ideas of how to treat this illness in Europe?
That's a good question. So if I give you now the recipe, I would be the first and only one. On the one hand, yes, you have to tackle each kind of anti-Semitism, whether it comes from the right or the left or the middle of the society. You know, I mean, the bourgeoisie, whether they're very well educated professors or architects or people who work on building sites, it doesn't matter where you come from. Anti-Semitism is widespread. And also now, because we have welcomed refugees from countries where students learn at schools, in kindergarten already, that Jews are horrible people, they bring their anti-Semitism with them here to Germany. And we have to see this as well and address this. So anti-Semitism in general has to be tackled. And then, of course, we have to focus on each single regional or political anti-Semitism. That is a huge, huge challenge. And if we think anti-Semitism came to Europe and especially to Germany with Christianity, then we know it's over 1,000 years old, and you can't change anti-Judaism, anti-Semitism within a few decades.
As you mentioned, because of Germany's history, the state has tended to be very good, or like put a lot of effort into memorializing and trying to face up to its history when it comes to anti-Semitism. This attitude that you saw at school, with the school officials not really wanting to deal with this problem, do you think the same kind of attitude is reflected higher up? Is there more that the government could be doing to stop this wave of anti-Semitism?
Politicians are saying all the right things, but it has become ritualized. Whenever there's an anti-Semitic wave in Germany, and we have those waves every now and then, we hear fantastic speeches, but on everyday levels, on the ground, there's not enough being done. The teachers, they're not trained to deal with these kind of problems. This has to be part of their training, of their job, to realize when there are anti-Semitic or xenophobic, any other discriminations on their schoolyards, in their classes, and immediately say stop.
This idea of kids from Arab backgrounds and refugees turning up with ingrained anti-Semitic ideas. No one's suggesting that all refugees are anti-Semites or anything like that. And certainly we have a massive problem on this continent with Islamophobia as well. But there is sadly a kind of pattern of this. In France, certainly there's been some high-profile cases of attacks by Muslims on Jews. You've talked about what we can do in schools, Fenzel, to teach kids that this is really not okay. But is there anything that can be done within communities to help people to get along better?
Yeah, I think communities have to meet each other. That would help already. So yesterday, for example, I was at the Berlin West Kippur protest, and it was very heartening to see Muslim women on top of their hijab, they had the kippah. And I saw then Orthodox Jewish women hugging Muslim women, and that was very heartwarming. And I think we need more actions and activities like this. We have to do also more on the non-Muslim, non-Jewish side. Germany has become a multicultural state. If you like it or not, that's the reality. It has become more and more diverse. But this diversity does not reflect on government levels. We need many more headmasters, teachers, judges, prosecutors, mayors, ministers who are migrants, or their parents were migrants. And we need to give refugees a much better perspective for their life. And this is not happening. And I heard from anti-discrimination officials that sometimes in some schools, kids who come from Muslim families are being systematically convinced that they should not go to university, that their place is much better working in a garage or in a supermarket. And for example, when I said in our school, can we talk to the parents of the kids who attacked my son, the headmaster, who prides himself of being a very liberal and left-wing, he said, there's no point in talking to them because they're just Muslims. Wow. Racism and arrogance is still ingrained in German society and has never really been tackled.
So from something really serious and like an essential crisis of Europe, we're onto something pretty flippant.
Nice segue.
Yeah, we're heading over to Scotland, to Dunbar, where there's just been the first International Stone Sacking Championship, or the second.
I think it's the second one.
The second.
What an amazing event. So this cropped up my friend Andy Buchanan. He's a photographer in Scotland, and we worked together all that time ago. Cast your minds back before the Scottish independence referendum. Do you remember that?
Oh, wow, yeah.
A lot has happened since then. And he's just a really cool guy. He works all around Scotland and beyond, around the world, as a press photographer. He also shoots a lot of rock concerts, which is pretty cool.
Oh, rock concerts.
Oh, I can't believe I didn't make the link. Let's save that one up and use it about 6 times during the interview.
Okay, defo.
Anyway, he posted on Facebook this week about a shoot that he'd done. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, we have to call Andy and find out what this is about, because it is so weird and wonderful. The European Stone Sacking Championships, which is this gathering of aficionados of this hobby, which I didn't really know existed, basically making really cool piles of rocks that look like they defy gravity, so balancing rocks at really improbable angles. And we need to know more about it, so let's give them a call. Quite hard talking about photography on the radio, but we're going to give it a go. Can you describe some of the most impressive stacks of stones that you saw at this weird and wonderful event?
I mean, they obviously completely seem to defy physics. You would get like a tiny stone with a massive stone balanced on it, like enormous. There's a photograph in this set that went out. He's got like this, his was like a roller coaster, like a theme park type thing. And on one side, there was like a little gate, and he had like a little line of people made of two stones each and varying sizes of people. And then he had a height restriction going in with a little stick that he'd made. So there was even a height restriction. I photographed one incredibly complex one. And as soon as I'd finished photographing it, a small gust of wind came and blew the whole thing over.
Oh.
So I felt somehow involved. Yeah. But these guys are all incredibly zen-like. They just kind of like, oh, well. Whereas I would just be going mad and lobbing the stones in the sea and all that. It's very strange that there was no yelling.
But were there really people from all over Europe there?
There really was. The guy who won it was a Spanish guy who won it last year. He's double stacking champion. He's got stacks of trophies, you could say. I wonder if he balances them on his mantelpiece. I don't know. There was a Spanish guy, there's an Italian guy, I talked to an Austrian guy. I mean, it's gone really big. Like, they got used in the South China Morning Post and the Hindustan Times yesterday. I didn't expect it to be, one, so popular, and two, so interesting, actually. It was really fascinating to watch these guys do their thing, because I couldn't for the life of me figure out how some of these things were standing, you know, at all.
It seems like there's actually a bit of controversy around it, though, as well. Like, some people were critical of the fact that they're moving these Neolithic rocks and say they should leave them where they are.
I mean, they're just moving them around where they are. I mean, the tide does that anyway. So I didn't really see any obvious destruction or dismantling of the beach or anything.
There weren't tons of protesters on the side, like, saying, leave our rocks, leave our rocks.
No one was yelling at them or anything like that. It's a very stony beach, so you walk around and you're not sure if you're standing on someone's work. You really got to watch and you can't trip or anything like that. It was pretty nerve-wracking for a while.
One of my favorite videos on YouTube of all time is a news report of someone reporting at one of these giant sandcastle building competitions, and the presenter who's interviewing the person who's just won with this enormous castle of sand trips over and falls right into the middle of the castle and completely destroys his work. It's taken him 5 days to build. It's amazing.
I was terrified of that. It is horrendous when you're standing there and it falls down, because you really feel like, you know, if I wasn't here, have I affected the air pressure or something?
Yeah.
I don't know, what have I done? Did I breathe too heavy? But these guys have got the most patience of just about anyone I've ever photographed.
When you're not shooting stone stacking competitions and political stuff in Scotland and further afield, you also shoot a lot of rock bands. And I just wondered who your favourite bands are to shoot.
For many years, I worked with an American heavy metal band called Anthrax. I've been friends with them for a very long time. I did a tour programme once for Meatloaf, which was quite a good experience.
What was Meatloaf like?
It's all very pleasant. Give me a six-pack of beer for Christmas, which is very generous. Which is very generous of them. And a Homer Simpson bottle opener.
Okay.
Oh, wow. Class.
And you've just come back from Afghanistan, haven't you? Doing a project about skateboarding, is that right?
Yeah. I was just doing a project with an organisation called Skatistan, who run schools in Afghanistan, South Africa and Cambodia. And skateboarding is the key that they use. They have skateboard lessons and then they'll go for school lessons.
That's so cool.
Because of their work, Afghanistan, bizarrely, now has the highest proportion of female skateboarders anywhere in the world.
That is an amazing statistic.
No way.
Yeah, and I have pictures of 4-year-old girls, 5-year-old Afghan girls in traditional Afghan clothing, skateboarding with helmets on and knee pads and headscarves and everything. It's completely incredible. I mean, it really is. And especially in a place like Afghanistan, where the obvious security issues, and these girls just love to go skateboarding. They absolutely love it.
That is a really wonderful and heartwarming thing to hear about. You have the greatest job in the world, Andy. You really do.
Well, I'm going to go and photograph later today a man in a suit. So
not so exciting.
It's not always full on.
I think that might be one of the most giggly interviews we've ever done, Katie.
Who knew that stacking stones could be a source of such mirth?
Yeah, I know. Well, once again, maybe the happy ending is redundant this week, but I'm going to do it anyway. This week's happy ending is perhaps a bit obvious, and it's unlikely you haven't heard about this unless you've been hiding under a stone somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Hiding under a big stack of rocks.
Yeah, but I was rejoicing when I got the BBC News alert that the undisputed kings and queens of Europop are back. ABBA have announced that they have recorded two new songs after disbanding 35 years ago. This is to accompany an upcoming Avatar tour, whatever that is.
A what?
And a BBC-NBC co-produced TV special in December where I think they are going to perform one of the songs actually in human form. They're not going to be touring in human form anytime soon because, yeah, I think that wouldn't be a good idea when they have quite a complicated history. But this is still pretty exciting. I really enjoyed this quote from Noel Gallagher that I found on the BBC website when I opened it. He said, "Purely from a songwriting point of view, they were up there with the best. They enter Eurovision singing about the Battle of Waterloo in platforms and they were all shagging each other. Does it get better than that?" He hit the nail on the head.
That's wonderful. I was thinking, Dominic, because you're a singer, would you maybe help us celebrate this amazing event by giving us a couple of lines of Dancing Queen?
No, absolutely not.
Come on!
I don't sing for free. So, but like, I think possibly ABBA are the most European of bands. I know Katie would argue that like IKEA is the most European thing that's ever existed. But in some ways, I think ABBA might be.
Ooh.
I mean, they sung about the Battle of Waterloo. And I actually think now when people hear Waterloo, they think of the ABBA song before they think of the Battle of Waterloo.
Yeah, true.
I was also talking to my husband about ABBA and he was saying that lots of people mishear ABBA lyrics, partly because they aren't native English speakers themselves. So they say the words not very clearly. And I found some online. So some people hear where it says, "Waterloo, I was defeated, you won the war." People mishear it as "Waterloo, how were your feet when you won the war?" Which I like. And another good one was in Chiquitita. "Chiquitita, you and I know." People hear it as "Chicken Tikka, doodle I do."
Yay, we did manage to get you to sing on the podcast.
Yeah, it's my day off singing. I don't want to sing.
Sorry. Really excitingly, Bjorn from ABBA was on the BBC's Brexit Cast podcast last week. Do you think he might come on ours to talk about this? Wouldn't that be amazing?
Yes.
Let's get ABBA on. ABBA, come on the show.
Seriously, they should be on the show. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of The Europeans. You should follow us on Twitter at EuropeansPod and you should do what Donald Tusk has done this week. He's the president of the European Council, if you don't know. He finally joined Instagram this weekend with the help of his grandsons. We've been there for ages, despite the fact that we don't have grandsons to help us understand how to do Insta stories, Katie. But we have been posting up a storm lately, so if you miss us between episodes, you should come and follow us by typing in Europeans Podcast into Instagram. I don't know if anyone actually actively misses us between episodes.
You most definitely do. You can also find us on Twitter, where we do talkings to go with the pictures from Instagram. We are there at Europeans Pod. And on Facebook as well, at facebook.com/EuropeansPodcast. We've had another really great week. I feel like the outro to this podcast has become a kind of self-congratulations corner, so I hope it doesn't come off as too smug. But we did get a shout-out on BBC Radio 2 this week. It's so exciting.
There's The Europeans, which is a podcast which is, you might think at first, because it's got the word Europe in it, you would think, oh, it's going to be about Brexit, but it actually isn't. It's just basically evaluating all the different stories across Europe, the weird, the wonderful, the wacky, brilliant, the sort of stuff that's happening in Germany and France that you just don't hear about in the news. It's presented by a journalist based in France and her friend based in Amsterdam, Dominic, and they just chat and it's just so well researched and it's so insightful.
So that was on the show of Claudia Winkleman, who is the host of flagship ballroom dancing show Strictly Come Dancing, saying that the idea for our show was, quote, brilliant. Thank you so much to Scott Bryan of BuzzFeed for recommending us there. And in other news, we got a message from Thomas in Uppsala in Sweden saying that we made him drop a piece of gym equipment because he was laughing too much at the programme. So we're going to have to start slapping health and safety warnings on the podcast, I think. Do not listen to the show while operating heavy machinery.
We're not responsible for anyone being injured, so I don't think we should even put that warning there, Katie, because that's like suggesting we're liable.
Let's get the lawyers involved.
Thank you for our guests this week, Benzel Mikalski and Andy Buchanan. Do make sure you check out Andy's documenting of the Stone Stacking Championship. We'll put a link to it in our show notes. They really are as weird and wonderful looking as he made them sound.
We hope your week is as peaceful and zen-like as a perfectly balanced pile of rocks on a Scottish beach. We'll see you next week, Europe. Bye.
Bye.